Thousands of hotel workers from 26 downtown Chicago hotels are on strike. What do they want? A guarantee of year-round health insurance in their new contracts.
We work hard for what we for the job, and they don't want to give us anything. And for us, for me, the health insurance is the most important thing, for year-round health insurance. So that's what I'm fighting for.
Plus, anyone with a severe food allergy knows the kind of anxiety that comes along with that. The constant fear that you or a loved one may take one wrong bite. But a few scientists in Illinois have figured out why there are so many allergy sufferers, and they're developing therapies that could help end the epidemic. And if you're looking for a place where your kids can go after school, the public library is one of them. Dozens of libraries have gotten money from the state to set up programs for developing tech skills. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we'll be speaking with Illinois scientists and doctors about their research working to prevent life-threatening food allergies. Also, we'll find out how dozens of libraries throughout the state are helping out not just with after-school care for kids, but teaching them technology skills at the same time. But first, thanks to the Chicago Tribune for that audio. That was Chance from Chicago's hotel workers who are on strike since Friday. Thousands of hotel workers of all kinds, housekeepers, cooks, doormen, and more, have been on strike at 26 different hotels in Chicago. The union contract that represents these workers expired on August 31st. And according to the union that represents them, this is the biggest coordinated hotel worker strike in Chicago history. Joining me on the line now from Chicago is Alexia Elejalde Ruiz. She's been covering the strike for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Alexia. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
And here in studio with me in Urbana is Stephanie Furtado. She's a lecturer in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for being here as well. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Alexia, can I start with you and just ask you if you can tell us a little bit more about the strike? First of all, how many, do we know exactly how many workers are on strike right now?
We don't. We know that there are 6,000 workers who are covered by the contracts that expired on August 31st, and those are at 30 different hotels. It's hard to know exactly how many workers decided to, you know, not work. I can tell you just from, you know, walking by these hotels every day, there are dozens and dozens of people outside of pretty much all of the hotels protesting. So the union is saying thousands.
And what are the workers who are protesting saying about why they're out on strike?
So they have a very narrow and consistent message, which is that they want year-round health insurance. So they're negotiating their new contracts with the hotels, and the union negotiates separately with each of the hotel brands. And what the workers are saying is that the one thing that's really important to them is that their colleagues who get laid off every year around November, when the weather gets cold and the business slows at hotels, that they lose their health insurance until they get, you know, back on the job in April or so and get it again. So they want to just guarantee that even when these people are not working, that they continue to have health insurance.
That's Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, who's with us from the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune. Stephanie Furtado is in studio with me. Stephanie, when Alexia talks about seasonal employment, and that is, I imagine, pretty typical within the service industry to only employ people certain times of the year.
Right. And that's a major issue for many unionized workers and just for workers in general, because if all of a sudden you lose your health care or you have to pay for it out of pocket, then you have to make really tough choices. Right. This is also true of the food service workers at the University of Illinois. They are in the middle of the summer. They lose their health care. And if they want to keep it, they have to pay for it out of pocket, the full premium. So people have, you know, in these situations, have to make tough decisions. You know, their cell phones get turned off. Right. They might have to move because they can't make rent, because if they have some sort of health condition, they have to decide between health care and other living costs. And, you know, at the same time, they're also not getting paid a lot of times because they're laid off and they're not working. So this is a major issue, not just in Chicago, but for service sector workers across the country. And you see unionized service workers making this more and more of an issue in their collective bargaining.
Alexia, when Stephanie mentioned wages, do we have a sense of what this a union that represents these workers is Unite here, correct? That's a now
correct.
It's a and so the local one. What do we know from the union in terms of what the average salary, average hourly wage is of these workers? As I said, it's a pretty big variety of kind of hotel work.
Right. So it depends, you know, on your tenure and on the type of job. The workers that I have talked to have been there for quite a long time. I talked to a young man, not a young man, a middle-aged man who works as a houseman, which, you know, they empty out the garbage and change their dirty linens. He's been there for 10 years. He makes $19.50 an hour. I talked to a housekeeper who's been at her job for, I think it was like 13 years, and she's making $20 an hour. And they were pleased, you know, the people who I spoke with about their wage. Of course, if you're, you know, if you're newer to the job, our minimum wage here is $12 right now. I'm not sure actually where they start because the wages are just not part of what they're clamoring for in this particular strike.
Really, they're focusing on healthcare, Alexia. And so would the idea be that they would like these hotels to continue to subsidize the employer part of the healthcare costs, even if they are not employed by the hotel? Is that what they're trying to figure out?
Exactly. That they want just like the same benefit that they have when they are working. They want that to continue when they're not working. So they just want, yeah, exactly. So for the employer to continue to subsidize their part of the premium.
Alexia, I mentioned 26 different hotels. What kind of hotels are we talking about here? Does this run across different chains?
Oh, yeah. So we have, I think, four different Hilton brands that are on there, like six different Marriotts, a bunch of Hyatts. So those are the three major hotel groups. So the Palmer House is kind of ground zero for a lot of the protests. It's such a huge hotel.
Right, and
hotel.
Clearly one of Chicago's most famous landmarks as a hotel,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Drake is also a Hilton-branded hotel. Workers are protesting there and striking there. The Westin hotels, the W hotels, like some of the Kimpton hotels, and then, of course, the JW Marriott, which owns a bunch of different hotels as well. So there's a huge range. They're all downtown. And, of course, the 26 hotels only represents a sliver of the entire hotel market in Chicago. It's not that all hotels are on strike.
And what have the hotels who are affected said in response to what the workers to these workers going out on strike?
So they have a couple messages. One is that they are open for business, that they don't expect operations to be impacted. So that's kind of, you know, directed to their guests and their customers. And then you know, they're also saying that they're disappointed that this strike has happened so early on in negotiations. The contract just expired August 31st. I know that Hyatt said it had only had two meetings, two contract negotiation meetings before the strike was called, and that the union had only barely started to present all of its proposals. And so even in the lead up to the strike, when I was talking to some of the hotels, they were like, we don't think there's going to be a strike. Like, you know, negotiations are going fine. And maybe they always say that, but, you know, they seem to be pretty genuinely like not taken aback because the union had been warning of that strike could be coming for a while. But they did thought that it was kind of premature given that they had just begun to negotiate.
That's Alexia Elejalde Ruiz. She's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. She's there at the Tribune newsroom updating us on this hotel worker strike. In studio with me in Urbana, labor relations expert Stephanie Furtado. She teaches in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Stephanie, strikes generally are kind of a last resort, right? Strikes are supposed to be the last line of a labor negotiation tactic. But when we think about the strikes that we've seen happen, and I'm thinking about earlier this year, we saw teachers striking in Kentucky and West Virginia and Oklahoma. Now we have this pretty big worker strike in Chicago. Do we see strikes becoming more used now? Because I felt like this was originally, traditionally had been, this is our last resort. Because it is very extreme. There's a lot of effects to the workers.
Sure. I mean, and I think, yes, I do think you're seeing right now a rise in worker action and also worker frustration. You know, you keep hearing that the economy is going in a good direction and all these positive news, but what happens is working families aren't seeing those benefits, right? And so you saw that wave of strikes, the teacher strikes, this strike, you know, in Chicago. And I think what's also really interesting is there's a lot of factors for when a strike is called. If they're trying to get a benefit that is for the winter months, you know, you're going to have to make your case for that and before that happens. And so there's a lot of reasons, I think, that timing.
September is so traditionally really, I would think, a pretty slow season for hotels. Alexia, correct me if I'm wrong. September is probably a pretty slow time for Chicago hotels.
September? No, September is pretty, I mean, it's relative. It's not as busy as maybe midsummer, but it's pretty busy.
It still is.
Season.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It's like the top wedding season also. So let's think about the Palmer House, Hilton, and the Drake. You know,
oh, wow. Okay. That's a good point. Yeah. Thanks, Alexia. Stephanie?
Right. And I had a chance on Monday. I was up in Chicago, and I stopped by the picket line at the Palmer House. And what was really interesting to me was the energy of the people on the picket line, just the commitment to what they were doing. And what I think is really interesting about this strike is there's workers committee from each hotel that decided whether they were going to participate in the strike. So the strike started with 25 hotels, and then yesterday another hotel who hadn't originally decided to participate joined in. And I think that the other thing that you're seeing a lot right now is that these strikes are coming from the workers themselves. I mean, that's, I think, the lesson of the teacher strikes, is that those were strikes that were being led by teachers in their schools saying that, you know, we need the resources in order to provide quality education for our students. And the same thing here is you're seeing workers making these decisions. And I think that that's a really important message about what's going on in labor right now, is that workers are often really at the forefront of these work actions.
So, Alexia, to Stephanie's point, there are actually 30 hotels that are covered in the contract. But what about those four other hotels? Why have they decided, the workers there haven't decided to or haven't voted to go out on strike? Is that how it works?
Yeah, Stephanie said there are kind of worker negotiating committees that represent each hotel or hotel group. And so those four hotels that are still, that have expired contracts that have not joined the strike, have just simply decided not to do so for one reason or another. And the Cambria Chicago Magnificent Mile Hotel is the one that joined the strike yesterday, becoming the 26th, or 2 days ago. And they said that they didn't do so at first just because they thought it was going to be a small strike. They thought it'd be over fast. I guess they just didn't feel terribly committed to it, but because of that energy that Stephanie was describing, and that people are really out there and they're really banging those drums, you know, and so they just felt really motivated and they wanted to be part of this big movement.
Alexia, to the organizer's point about this being the biggest coordinated hotel worker strike, do we know if that's accurate?
That's a great question. You know, it's always hard to say anything is the biggest or the oldest or whatever. They are the union, you know, that represents 15,000 hospitality workers. So they're saying it's the broadest strike that they have ever called. Obviously, there have been other strikes, hotel worker strikes in Chicago, as we can all probably remember, the Congress Hotel strike that lasted forever and ever.
That was very long.
That was very long and little one-offs. So I haven't been able to find another example of such a broad hotel worker strike. But so that's what they're saying. But, I mean, I don't know. Stephanie might know.
I think that they're probably accurate that that's the biggest in terms of site locations all at once. I can't think of anything that compares to it.
Stephanie, I think when people think about the service industry and the fact that it's seasonal work, how often is this work unionized when we're talking about hotel work?
You know, it really varies. So, you know, if you are in a place like Las Vegas, right, the union density is incredibly high. Or in Chicago, there are a lot of unionized hotels, you know, because of years of organizing. But then if you go to some of the downstate, you know, in Illinois cities, it'll be a lot harder to find unionized hotels. And those workers, you know, they don't have collective bargaining agreements. Often those workers are paid minimum wage or just over minimum wage. And they often have very unpredictable schedules and often are held below the amount of hours that they would need in order to get benefits.
And when you say they're held below that, you mean they work under a full-time schedule so those employers do not have to offer health care?
Exactly.
And that, and when we think about working conditions, so that's sort of the idea of wages and health care. Are there other benefits in terms of vacation and sick time? I know we've heard that as a common complaint, for example, in the food service industry, that there's not sick time.
Right. And that's an issue across service sector is, you know, not just not having health care offered, but not having sick time, you know, family medical leave, that kind of thing is difficult to get through the employer in the service sector with if you are not represented by a collective bargaining agreement.
Alexa, as you said, this strike is a little unusual in that it's a very focused demand, which is just this healthcare component. Have you, just as we wrap up here, have the hotels said anything about that healthcare component, the employers?
Yeah, you know, they haven't. They, as you can imagine, the hotels and the responses are giving a statement, you know, a corporate statement, and they haven't addressed the specific healthcare question about whether that is something that they would be open to doing or why it might not be. They have said that they have not reached any impasse on any issue so far.
Okay, so obviously, while the strike is happening, Alexia, are negotiations still ongoing?
Several of the hotels say that they have sessions, negotiating sessions scheduled through September. So presumably those will happen. I guess the workers or the negotiating committees have to decide whether they come off of the strike line to go
to the bargaining table.
Mm-hmm. To go to the bargaining table. But, I mean, the expectation is that, yes, those sessions will continue.
That's Alexia Elejalde-Ruiz with the Chicago Tribune. We'll tweet out her reporting on this issue of the Chicago hotel worker strike. I want to thank Stephanie Furtado with the U of I's School of Labor and Employment Relations for being with us as well. Stephanie, Alexia, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of University of Illinois, Engine of Innovation, documenting 175 years of innovation in agriculture, engineering, and the arts at the University of Illinois. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years. Support for the 21st comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting video, sound, and sculpture by Irish artists Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown in the exhibition Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship, opening October 4th at 5:30 p.m. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I wonder how many of you listening have a food allergy, or maybe you have a child that does. Then you also know the anxiety that comes along with that. I'm talking about the constant worry that you or your loved one may take one wrong bite. Personally, I'm terrified that one day I may have to use an EpiPen and not stab the right place. Life-threatening allergic reactions to food have actually increased by 5 times over the last decade. That's according to a new analysis from private insurance claims. But there is some hope in terms of understanding why and developing solutions for allergies, and some of that hope is coming out of right here in Illinois. Chicago Magazine senior editor Lauren Williamson recently investigated this for the magazine's September issue, and she joins us now. Hi, Lauren. Welcome back to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm also joined by Dr. Ruchi Gupta. She's a professor of pediatrics at Lurie Children's Hospital in Northwestern Medicine. And Catherine Nagler's with us as well. She's a food allergy researcher and professor at the University of Chicago, where she teaches in pathology, medicine, and pediatrics. Dr. Gupta, Professor Nagler, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Lauren, I wonder if I could start with you. This is actually a personal issue for you. You have a young son with allergies?
I do, yeah. I have a 20-month-old son who, at the time that I wrote the story, we believed he had 3 food allergies, so we have just had his annual blood test results that now we think he's down to 2, so we're moving in the right direction. But he is allergic officially to peanuts and eggs.
And for the parent, what was the number one thing you wanted to learn, Lauren?
The number one thing I wanted to learn, and what actually set me on the path to writing this story, is what can I do to help my son? Because it's such an overwhelming diagnosis when you learn your child has a food allergy, because all of a sudden there are all these foods that that child must avoid. And it's not just peanut butter itself, for example, but it's anything that may come into contact with peanuts at any point during the manufacturing process or with eggs. And So all of a sudden, huge areas of food are completely eliminated from his diet. The range of reactions that could happen could be anywhere from a few hives to a full-blown anaphylactic reaction, and you never know what's going to happen. And so that anxiety is huge. And so then I wanted to know, okay, well, how can I fix this? And I started to learn about all of this research that's going on to help create treatments for food allergies beyond just an EpiPen that would be used in a severe reaction. And I started discovering it, that so much of it was actually coming right out of Illinois and out of Chicago. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, I want to share this with other people, too, all of the stuff that I'm discovering.
Dr. Gupta, Lauren mentioned that anxiety, the dread if you or your child accidentally consumes one of these allergens. And I wonder, I think there are people who are listening who maybe don't have allergies, who don't think about or maybe are not aware of how serious this could be. How serious can this be and how common is this problem?
Yeah, so food allergies impact about 8% of children. So that's about, you know, 1 in 13 kids, so about 2 in every classroom. And that's why I think we've seen so much more awareness about this, even in schools and everywhere you go. As far as severity, what's so interesting is, you know, kids with food allergy, you know, are, you know, totally fine the majority of time, but there's this intense fear that if they came in contact with their allergenic food, you know, they could have a reaction. And, you know, as Lauren said, that reaction could be mild to, you know, life-threatening. And, you know, in our survey, when we looked at 40,000 kids across the United States, we found that over 40% of them had experienced one of these life-threatening reactions in their life. And about 1 in 5 of these kids were going to the emergency room in the past year for an allergic reaction. So that's what makes it, you know, so difficult, is you don't know when this is going to happen. And food, you know, is a part of everything everyone does, but especially kids. You know, it's a part of 3 meals a day and snacks and play and sports and celebrations. And so I think this is what makes it very difficult for families with food allergy.
It is difficult for families. I know this is a big part of my family and talking to people about this. Lauren, you spoke with one mother who described anaphylaxis as watching her kid drown. And fortunately, you haven't had to experience this, but obviously you're trying to avoid all of these experiences for your child. What kind of steps do you have to take?
Well, whenever we eat out, we have to wipe down the table and the high chair with wipes before we sit my son down, because we don't know what has been on those surfaces before we got there. We have to call manufacturers for any processed foods to find out what their processes are like. Do they have separate lines? What are their cleaning procedures like if they do use shared lines? Because the labeling laws aren't quite as clear-cut as you would hope they would be, so it's not always clear if there's a possibility that an allergen might be in a packaged food. We have made our house a safe zone, so we don't have any of the foods that my son is allergic to in our house, so that we can feel that he has, like, a place where we can, you know, feel a little bit more comfortable, and we don't have to worry if he just grabs something off the shelf. We've already vetted it. But then at the same time, my husband and I make sure that we continue to eat the foods that he's allergic to when we're outside of the home, because if you start avoiding a food, it's possible to develop an allergy later in life. There are other ways you can develop it too, but that's one of the risk factors, is if you stop eating a food itself. So it's a lot of work. And because it's everything that he puts in his mouth, we have to double check and make sure that it's safe. And we've trained his daycare providers how to spot an allergic reaction, how to properly clean everything that he's in contact with in the daycare. And, you know, we're really fortunate we have great partners there. But it's, you know, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of stress.
That's Lauren Williamson. She's a senior editor at Chicago Magazine. We'll tweet out that story that Lauren wrote about for their September issue. Dr. Ruchi Gupta is also with us. She's a professor of pediatrics at Lurie Children's Hospital in Northwestern Medicine. And Catherine Nagler is also on the line with us. She's a food allergy professor. She teaches in the Department of Pathology, Medicine, and Pediatrics at the University of Chicago, where she's also in the College of Biological Sciences. Catherine Nagler, Professor Nagler, to bring you into this conversation, you're working on trying to understand why so many people have food allergies these days. And one of the prevailing theories relates to hygiene. I wonder how our immune system, and in particular, how we approach hygiene, relates to allergies these days.
Yes, that's correct. I'd like to probably word it a little bit differently. So what we are seeing is really a generational change. When I was a child, food allergies were relatively rare. Now, as you've already heard from Dr. Gupta, they're fairly common. And the hypothesis is that we've changed our microbiome. That is the trillions of bacteria that live in and on our body in such a way that we've depleted bacterial populations that are protective against allergic disease. So hygiene comes into the picture because this concept was originally associated with enhanced cleanliness in society, vaccination, and reduced exposure to infectious disease. But it's now clear that it's not removing exposure to pathogens, but changes in our normal bacterial component that are driving what is sometimes called what are sometimes called the diseases of Western society. So not only food allergy, but inflammatory bowel disease, obesity, diabetes, autism, asthma, they're all increasing in parallel. So what are some of these lifestyle factors? Antibiotic use is the primary culprit. Diet is also a very, very big factor. So we have co-evolved with these bacteria over millennia, and our ancestors didn't eat McDonald's. They ate a diet that was very high in fiber, low in processed food, low in dietary fat, and we've changed the food source that the bacteria need to live and multiply in our guts.
And that's why that matters, Professor Nagler, because the bacteria, we're talking about food that we consume, that's important for the bacteria within us?
Sure, they eat what we eat. So if we don't give them the diet that, if we don't give particular populations of bacteria, so let's focus on the allergy protective populations, if we don't give them the food that they need, they're not going to thrive. And it happens that the bacteria that we've identified that are allergy protective are those that are particularly good at fermenting dietary fiber, so breaking down the fiber in our diet to produce molecules that have vital roles in stimulating the immune system and providing maintaining the healthy intestinal barrier and preventing allergic disease.
So we got a question on Twitter from a listener, Mary. She says, please ask these people, I guess our guests here, on behalf of this food allergy mom, what are the 2 to 3 most effective things we can do now for her kids, for their kids? Hers is 14, has a peanut allergy, peanut, tree nut, sesame seeds, plus celiac. That's the problems that she's dealing with. She asked about probiotics, Professor Nagler. She asked about herbs. What do you think in terms of what exists right now?
So there's a lot of controversy about probiotics. Generally, the probiotics that currently exist are yogurt-type bacteria. They've not shown to be effective in the treatment of disease. Whether or not they are helpful in situations of gastrointestinal distress is debatable. But they're not helpful in treating allergy. So what we're trying to do is create, we don't call them probiotics, we call them microbiome modulating therapeutics, of entirely new class of bacteria based on the bacteria that live in the absence of oxygen way deep in our GI tracts. Those are the ones that are important in protection that according to our studies, and their products are what we need to replace.
And that's what you're studying? That's what you're researching,
yes.
Those?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we formed a startup company called Clostrobio that is actually taking this basic science work
has taken it into a company so that we can bring it all the way to clinical trials to develop new treatments that will restore the functionality of the bacteria in our gut, not replace the diversity that was present in previous generations. There's not really a realistic way of doing that, but restore the function, the vital functions that have been lost.
Dr. Gupta, as you listen to Professor Nagler talk about the science side of this, what researchers are doing, there's also been some changes. You helped develop the American Academy of Pediatrics new guideline, I think this was last year, correct? Encouraging earlier introduction of potential allergens. Can you remind us what that change looks like?
Sure. In the past, 15, 20 years, the research has really expanded in food allergy. And, you know, there are treatments that are on the horizon coming out, you know, hopefully in the next year to 2 years. But, you know, along with treatments, there's prevention. And this is really important. I'm glad you asked because, you know, as we think about, you know, causes of food allergy, one large study in London found that early introduction of peanuts specifically could prevent food allergy or peanut allergy in infants that are at highest risk. And by high risk, I mean infants that have eczema as infants and severe eczema and or, you know, other allergies, specifically egg allergy. Those infants are at high risk for the development of a peanut allergy. And so this study found that if those infants were introduced to peanut-containing products around 4 to 6 months of age, ideally, their immune system, which is in development, would recognize that food and potentially not develop that allergy. So why this is really important is, you know, parents of newborns, you know, it is so critical that you talk to your pediatrician about this, because if they are infant with no risk factor, so no eczema, no other allergies, you know, introducing peanut products into their diet early as they start introducing solids is really useful for the prevention, but especially parents of infants who may have eczema and those risk factors, talking to your physician early, getting referred to an allergist and getting appropriate testing, and then potentially introducing peanut products over time in those early months could prevent their development of a peanut allergy. So we're kind of attacking it from both ends. You know, it'd be great to treat all our children, including mine, who has food allergies with these new treatments coming to market, but also can we help to prevent it in the new generation of children?
Dr. Gupta, I did want to end. We just have a minute or two left, but I did want to ask you about that, what you think people don't understand as someone who's both, as you said, a parent who has personal experience and as someone who's the director of science and outcomes of allergy and asthma research for Northwestern. What are you hoping that more people are aware of and understand more about?
Well, for the general public, I really appreciate all the amazing support, you know, for kids with food allergy, you know, being really understanding of the fact that this is not like, you know, an environmental allergy. It's not just going to cause, you know, runny nose and watery eyes, but it could, you know, be life-threatening. It could cause trouble breathing. It could cause a drop in blood pressure, and it could happen very rapidly. So the awareness of the general public that this is a real condition, and it really takes everyone's support, because especially for our children, you know, I think the hardest thing that causes anxiety for families with children with food allergy is they're not in your care most of the time. So you're really depending, especially when your children are very young, and then as they get into the teen years, on their friends to help support them in terms of, you know, being very vigilant in avoiding their allergen. And so I guess the biggest piece is, you know, food allergy is different than other types of allergies. It's a significant, potentially life-threatening issue in these kids. And if we all work together to support them, to help them manage their food allergy by avoiding the food and knowing how to recognize a reaction, how to use epinephrine.
All of those, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. But thank you so much, Dr.
Yeah.
Gupta. I want to thank Professor Nagler for being with us as well as Lauren Williamson. Thank all of you. I appreciate it.
Support for the 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a performance by the Karuna Trio, bringing their rhythm and sonic languages to Spurlock Museum on Sunday, September 16th at 2 p.m. This event is part of the Improvisers Exchange Initiative. More information at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By now, the first few weeks of school have gotten underway pretty much almost everywhere in Illinois. And during those hours, parents go to work knowing for the most part their kids will be taken care of. But what about after school? Especially if parents are working, have young children, and maybe can't afford to pay for expensive programs that promote learning after school is out for the day. We actually talked about this yesterday on the program, but today, Secretary of State Jesse White's office recently awarded more than $500,000 to local libraries to help address this problem. Dozens of libraries received grants that were given specifically to areas that serve low-income children and families. And we wanted to learn more about these libraries and get a sense of what after-school options, affordable ones, are out there for kids and families in Illinois. Joining us now on the line from Decatur is Robert Edwards. He's an assistant city librarian for the Decatur Public Library. And with us from our partner station, NPR Illinois in Springfield, William Leggy is executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Central Illinois. Robert, William, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Robert, I wonder if we can start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about the Decatur Public Library, what kinds of programs you have for students after school?
Sure. The Decatur Public Library is a part of a consortium of Illinois Heartland Library Systems. The Illinois Heartland Library System, they have about 500 libraries that are combined. Part of that is SHARE, and the Decatur Public Library is like the largest library, public library in SHARE. We service the community of Decatur and the Macon County areas. There are approximately 280,000 items at the Decatur Public Library, and we probably see about 700 people come in and out of the library a day. So we have a lot of people coming in and out. We have everything from books to DVDs, CDs, online streaming. So we have a lot that we have to offer as far as the physical activities, but we also have a lot of programs. We have programs for children like book discussions for youth. We have the Ridiculous Junior. We have the Project Next Generation, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. And we even have movies and things like that.
Right. The Project Next Generation, Robert, that's the funding you got from the state. I understand more than $14,000. What is that program about?
Okay. Project Next Generation is a grant from the state of Illinois State Library, to be exact, and it encourages their personal growth and educational development of at-risk students. And we use mentors, we use technology, and we use library-based group projects. We try to partner with other community groups that are working with youth. We found that to be the best way to reach out to the community as a whole, as opposed to us going out trying to recruit, youth in. So we invite those community groups in under the umbrella of the Project Next Generation.
Okay. We're speaking with Robert Edwards, who's an assistant city librarian at Decatur Public Library. William Lake, he's also with us from Springfield, where he's executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Central Illinois. William, as you're listening to Robert, I wonder what your thoughts are on the needs that places like not just the public library, but Boys and Girls Clubs can fill, given the challenge that many parents face when it comes to finding a place for their children after school while they're still at work.
Yeah. Hi, Nyla. It's tough for working parents, especially some of the younger parents. What we see in the Boys and Girls Club is that, a lot of our parents are single parents. They're under the age of 25. Not only are they trying to raise their young children themselves, but they're also at the beginning of their own careers. Speaking with a mother the other day, she works a full-time job, cleans houses on the side, and is going to school part-time to finish her education. And with all of that, she's quite strapped and doesn't have the ability to pay hundreds of dollars a month in childcare or daycare, but at the same time does not have the luxury to stay home or be available available from 3 p.m. forward to take care of her own kids. So, you know, it's programs like what they're doing over in Decatur and like what the Boys and Girls Club is doing here in Springfield that provides that affordable option for parents to know that their kids have a safe place to go after school, a place that's focused on academics, but also, you know, gives them the freedom and flexibility to achieve their own goals. And in many cases, like, you know, with a young parent trying to finish her own education, you know, that's critical for getting the earning potential needed to really raise a family in the first place.
And William, to that point of affordability, this was part of a whole conversation we had yesterday about childcare, and particularly if you are lower income, how tough it is to pay for childcare. And I think the cost that was quoted on the program yesterday was $17,000 a year for childcare for infants, maybe $14,000 if they are younger children. How much does that sound about right to you when you're thinking about kind of a conventional or kind of a regular aftercare daycare program situation?
Yeah, you know, the feedback I hear from parents that have struggled with finding affordable alternatives, and then of course when we take a look at, you know, what it costs our organization to operate, given the number of children that we serve, it's not cheap.
And how much do you all charge for the Boys and Girls Club? Is there a fee?
There is. So we do have a fee at the Boys and Girls Club. It costs $40 for an annual membership. Now, I will say that that fee is not something that we budget for from an income standpoint, but it becomes a talking point to ensure that, you know, as parents come in and try to get information about enrolling their child, you know, we want to make sure that there's a good buy-in from all sides, because this only works if we're a team. You know, we're not just a place for the parents to drop their kid off and get daycare and pick them back up. You know, we have a lot of educational and academic focused programs that are really trying to make an impact in their educational attainment, and that only works if we have a good relationship and can and have an open dialogue back and forth. So, you know, we set that $40 fee just so that the parents will stop and recognize that there is some value in our program. But at the same time, even that $40, I would say probably 30% of our youth get a scholarship every year, and we never let inability to pay become a barrier. It's really just an opportunity to have that conversation with the parents about what it is that we do and how we can support each other for the success of their children.
And William, to your point about the content, when people think about aftercare programs, I think traditionally we've seen this as time for kids to maybe play, work on their homework. You're talking about a whole other level of continuing to teach children skills. And that's part of what the work that you all do when they have. What do you think is important about having children have access to technology and skills in an aftercare program?
Oh, it's critically important. And, you know, we fully recognize that, you know, after a child's been in school all day, we can't just be an extension of that school day. You know, they're exhausted, they're hungry by the time they walk through the club, and their brains are, you know, kind of on overload with all the classroom work they've already done. So we have to find creative ways to have what we call fun with a purpose. So as it relates to technology, we have a full computer lab with 23 terminals in it. The kids, it really is one of the most popular rooms in the club. And we try to make sure that the kids are, you know, having access to not only, you know, some of the quote-unquote games that they enjoy and that are fun, but also that those games maybe have an underlying educational value that they may not recognize at the time, but are still helping them learn something. And as you know, as you look at the you know, job landscape today, I think you'd be pretty hard pressed to find, you know, any level employment, whether that's entry level and all the way through executive, that doesn't require a technological skill set. So, you know, we have to start very early. You know, looking at, you know, some of the curriculum that they're doing in the schools, we've gotten rid of handwriting in a lot of schools throughout the country because everything's transitioning to a computer-based model. You know, the basics of programming and operating a computer are critical for any job. You know, like I said, even if it's an entry-level part-time job, there's bound to be a piece of technology that has to be utilized.
That's William Leggy. He's executive director of the Boys and Girls Club of Central Illinois. Robert Edwards is also on the line with us, where he's with the Decatur Public Library. And Robert, to William's point, I understand that this grant, some of the grant money that you've gotten, are going to enable programs, including things like virtual reality programs for the Decatur Public Library.
Exactly. These are the type of conversations that we like to be in because we want to know what's needed out in the community. And he mentioned that, you know, the different learning in after school, the technology being available. And so at the library, through Project Next Generation, we've been able to acquire computers. We've also recently just got a 3D printer, which we've been introducing to the youth. And this next segment, we're looking at the virtual reality. So that's something that's being used, you know, across the nation in libraries and schools to teach, you know, it's also to get kids involved with technology and learning in a fun way. So we're kind of excited about it. You know, I think the project itself should be starting up pretty soon. We have to get our mentors together. So it'll be after school and most likely on Saturdays. And as I said, it's Project Next Generation. It's not just, you know, we're reaching out for almost a whosoever will as far as youth is, you know, so we don't want to just restrict it to some youth. We want all the youth that want to be available, that can be available.
And you mentioned mentors, Robert. What are the role will the mentors play in this?
Well, the mentors are very important. They're crucial to me anyway, because it saves a lot of legwork for me. For example, at our last project, we had Dr. Sherrard, Jeremy Sherrard from Richland Community College. She had a group. Dr. Janelle Norman, who worked with some community groups, and we had some more mentors from I think Webster Cantrell and some of the schools that worked with us to work with the kids and to get the groups of kids in. Also, and you know, they were he mentioned transport. Getting the kids here to the library and helping us set up programs, structured programs, so they would, you know, we'd actually have something to work on when they were here.
William, to Robert's point about mentors, as we've been talking about the technology, as we've been talking about teaching them skills, how important also are those human relationships that particularly the young people have with older people in their lives?
You know, there's a saying that we have around the Boys and Girls Club, and that's that, you know, every child is but, you know, one caring adult away from becoming a success story. And I couldn't believe in that more passionately. You know, mentors are a critical part of development, and in a lot of cases, we may not call it a mentor relationship. You know, in some cases, it's a family member or a friend or a neighbor. But in the development of any child, they so desperately need to know that there is a caring adult out there that is watching out for them and cares for them and wants to help them learn and grow and flourish. Without mentors, we'd be lost as a society.
I think if there are folks who are listening who want to learn more about these programs, particularly if there are people in the Decatur area, as I mentioned, this is happening all over the state. Robert, where's the best source of information for them to go to? Is it your website?
The best source is our website. It's under construction right now, but it's still up and running, available. Or they can call the library and just talk with, ask for Robert. The library, anyone can actually direct them to, you know, where they need to go.
So if you're in Decatur, they can call you, but for folks who are listening all over the state, they can call the library. William, your website, your phone number is also a good resource, I imagine, for folks?
Yeah, absolutely. There's two resources, really. So if you're in the Springfield community and you want to learn more about our organization and the 9 sites we have in the area, you can go to bgccil.org and learn all about the Boys and Girls Clubs of Central Illinois. But, you know, I also recognize that you have a statewide audience, and, you know, we are just one of 27 independent Boys and Girls Clubs across the state. And with that, those organizations have over 100 club sites, everywhere from Chicago to Carbondale, Moline to Danville. And you can find any club in the country by going to our national organization's website, and that's bgca.org. There's a club finder. You plug in a zip code, and it'll show you every club, you know, anywhere in the country.
Gentlemen, thanks for that. I appreciate it. I'm afraid we're out of time for today, for the segment and for the program, but I want to thank Robert Edwards with the Decatur Public Library, William Legge, Executive Director of the Boys and Girls Club of Central Illinois. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the program, this week marks 10 years since the beginning of the Great Recession. Starting with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, we're going to take a look at what's changed in those 10 years and what hasn't, and we want to hear from you. What do you remember from 2008, and are you still feeling the effects of that recession today? Please leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on this, and tune in tomorrow for the program. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on today and past programs. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow.